happen to live in a social and political system in which there are two political organizations, one of them essentially moderate Republican, Clinton, another off the spectrum. And we can say, I don't like it, but we can't say it's not there. We can try to do something about it. But to do something about it begins by accepting its reality and trying to change it. And you don't change it by voting for the worst person. You change it by spending 5 minutes realizing that we got to keep the worst person out and then go back to the serious activity of organizing and activism.
That's Noam Chomsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Noam Chomsky on elections and voting. What's your favorite flavor? Trump? Hillary? Maybe Jill Stein or Gary Johnson? Or maybe you were one of the 13 million Bernie Sanders voters. A lot of people invest heavily in emotional terms in elections. Hopes are raised to the skies. Then there are disappointing defeats. Or if your candidate wins and assumes office, disillusionment sets in. And you say, oh man, how could I have been so wrong? Know the feeling? Maybe that emotional investment is misplaced. Often real change comes not from elected officials, but from activists and movements that pressure elected officials. Some of the great social and political advancements have come far removed from the ballot box. Think of Mahatma Gandhi. Think of the suffrage movement and the handful of women who began it in Seneca Falls, New York. Or Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King Jr. Our guest today is Noam Chomsky. By any measure, he has led a most extraordinary life. In one index, he's ranked as the 8th most cited person in history, right up there with Aristotle, Shakespeare, Marx, Plato, and Freud. The legendary MIT professor practically invented modern linguistics. In addition to his pioneering work in that field, he's been a leading voice for peace and social justice for many decades. Chris Hedges says he's America's greatest intellectual who makes the powerful as well as their liberal apologists deeply uncomfortable. At 87, he still gives lectures all over the world. He's the author of scores of books, and he and I have done a series of books, including Propaganda and the Public Mind, How the World Works, and Power Systems. I talked with Noam Chomsky at his office at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. What about the state of politics today? Do you recall a period where there's been so much vitriol and recrimination and rancor and rage?
Well, I don't recall it, but it has happened in American history. In fact, if you go back to the very early days, 1790s, the viciousness and vitriol of the personal attacks were pretty shocking. And it's happened through the years, but not in recent years. There's been nothing like this. There's something very strange about the entire American political system in the last roughly 30 years. There used to be a kind of a quip, I think it may go back to C. Wright Mills, that the United States is a one-party state with the business party, and it has two factions, Democrats and Republicans. It's not entirely true anymore. There's now basically only one faction, moderate Republicans, who call themselves Democrats. The Democratic Party has shifted far enough to the right so that it's approximately what moderate Republicans, like, say, Nelson Rockefeller, for that matter, Eisenhower, used to be like, 40, 50 years ago. And meanwhile, the Republicans have just drifted off the spectrum. They don't resemble a political party anymore. We've talked about this. The current campaign is absolutely astonishing for reasons that are not discussed, which is even more astonishing. So the major issues that humans face now. There are two enormous issues, climate change and nuclear war. They're simply not discussed. If you take the Republican primary, every single candidate denied anthropogenic climate warming, simply denied the facts. Facts are overwhelmingly clear by this time. There was one exception, John Kasich. He said, yeah, it's happening, but we shouldn't do anything about it, which is even worse. So it's 100% refusal to face the most important question that humans have faced in their history. On nuclear war, also virtually nothing. Side comments here and there about usually framed in terms of the Russian aggression and how do we respond to it. But the fact that this is happening in the most powerful country in world history, by comparative standards, an educated, privileged country, and total denial of matters that are of just extraordinary significance, and no comment on it, is just indescribable. I don't know how you talk about that, how to even comment on it. The commentary that is taking place is pretty marginal by comparison, as compared with this overwhelming fact looming before us and not seen. And it's having effects. It's not just abstract. So, for example, the Paris negotiations, COP21, they weren't as strong as they should be, but they were at least some kind of step and at least the basis for maybe moving on. They could not reach a verifiable treaty. It was only an agreement, informal agreement. The reason was very clear, couldn't get through the Republican Congress. So here you have a political organization, one of the two main political organizations, which is essentially saying, let's race to the precipice as fast as possible. And if you look at the candidate, Trump, he's being condemned for all sorts of things by liberal commentators, but not for the most important thing, his policies on the climate. What he's saying is more fossil fuels, more coal plants, NDPA regulations, maybe dismantle the EPA, dismantle the Paris Agreement, no support for developing countries to do something. That really is saying, let's race to the precipice. And it's a very serious issue. This is not far off. I mean, actually, we're already close to, if not past, the limits that were proposed for the Paris discussions, 1.5C. But it's just as if it doesn't exist.
What is Trump saying that some Americans find receptive? Now, the standard explanation, and I want to know what you think of this, is that, well, good-paying blue-collar jobs have disappeared, leaving a rust belt and angry workers in its wake.
There's surely something to that. It's true that the white working class has essentially been abandoned. The Democrats gave up on them 40 years ago. They don't offer them anything. The Republicans offer them even less. What they offer them is a punch in the nose, including Trump. But they have a rhetorical style which makes it sound as if they're working for them. If you look at his budget, basically Paul Ryan's budget, it's devastating for working people. Increased spending on the military, reduced taxes on the rich, no new resources. What's left? Well, you work out the details, as some economists have done, and there's essentially nothing for any moderately constructive element of the government. Destroy the healthcare system, scandalous, so let's make it worse. Every specific proposal is just, like I said, a punch in the face to working people. But the rhetoric says we're for you. And what's true is everyone's against you. Nothing has been offered them by either political party, and people are angry. Now, on the other hand, close, careful analyses of Trump supporters as compared with attitude studies, for example, Tony DiMaggio's work, shows that there's a very close correlation with authoritarian personalities. Patriarchy, authoritarianism, racism, ultranationalism, and so on. So these are factors that are significant as well. But I wouldn't discount at all the idea that especially the white working class is just extremely angry, and for good reasons. They've been cast to the wind. Real wages are roughly what they were in the 1960s, actually have declined since the recession, the latest recession. Meanwhile, there's enormous wealth, highly concentrated, very visible. And why shouldn't they be angry? The solutions that are proposed will make it worse, but that's a different question, Trump's proposals.
I'm hesitant to use the word fascist because it's bandied about, I think, quite promiscuously, but there's a whiff of fascism in the air. And, you know, I've been looking at novels, actually, like Sinclair Lewis, It Can't Happen Here, Robert Penn Warren, All the King's Men, which is kind of about Huey Long and Louisiana. And more recently, Philip Roth wrote a book, The Plot Against America. Is there any credence to that notion that there are fascistic tendencies in this Trump campaign?
Well, I think the examples that you gave belie that conclusion. Notice the dates. This tendency goes way back. It's always there. There's elements of it in the Trump campaign. You brought up the 30s. I remember it very well from the 30s with Father Coughlin orating against Jews and blacks on the Boston Common, or my own neighborhood, which we've probably discussed, which was virulently anti-Semitic. And, of course,
Huey Long.
Huey Long was a combination of a kind of populist and quasi-fascist. It's complex. But it's always been there. And something is being brought out in the Trump campaign. But to call Trump a fascist, I think, is very misleading. It attributes too much to him. I don't think he has any conception of any ideology or pretty much anything except give me what I want and I'll somehow do something for you. I'll make America great again. For example, he was asked in the military forum debate, what are you going to do about ISIS? And his answer was something like, first I'm going to make America great again, and then I'm going to call the generals, and they'll give me a plan, and I have my plan, and I'll decide which plan is best, and then we'll go ahead and get rid of them. But first I'll make America great again. How? Well, whatever that means. But that's not fascism. It doesn't rise to that level. It has no plausible political category that it belongs to. Huey Long had policies.
Well, that slogan, Make America Great Again, taps into a nostalgia for an imagined past, America that never really existed, but is imagined.
Not entirely imagined. There was a time when the United States had a lot more clout in the international scene than it has today. So, for example, you go back to the early post-war period, post-Second World War. The United States just had overwhelming power. Actually, you can see it, interestingly, in the history of the United Nations. If you look at the history, it's very striking. The UN was a tool in the hands of the United States, a battering ram against Russia. That's been lost. Take the a very striking fact, which is not much discussed but very significant, is the role of the International Monetary Fund. The IMF is pretty much run by the U.S. Treasury. They have overwhelming power there. They defer to the Europeans in dealing with Europe, but for the rest of the world, it's been essentially a U.S. tool. And it's been a tool of U.S. dominance. over much of the world. That has radically declined since the Asian financial crisis in the late 90s. The Asian countries simply refused to accept IMF loans. In the current millennium, the Latin American countries have simply kicked out the IMF. They don't take IMF loans with their conditionalities. IMF loans now overwhelmingly go to Europe. It's a radical shift, and it's a sign of the decline of U.S. power worldwide. It's not something that's in the headlines, but it's a very significant one. So if you take a look at the U.S. state, its power to dominate the world has indeed declined. On the other hand, if you look at U.S. corporations, their ownership of the world has remained very stable. U.S. corporations still own about probably close to 50% of the world economy. And so take, say, your iPhone, maybe Apple. Apple has a Taiwanese corporation, Foxconn, which runs huge assembly plants in China, and it employs Chinese workers in miserable conditions. The value added in China to the iPhone is very slight. Almost all the profit goes back to Apple and its subsidiaries. And that means that the United States, a large part of the gross domestic product of China, is actually owned by not only Apple, but other corporate U.S. corporations. So U.S. corporate power, business power, is still extraordinary, probably hasn't declined. But U.S. power to run the world has declined. And of course, there's another respect in which there's some truth to the looking back to, with nostalgia. There was a big growth period. 50s and 60s were a period of the highest growth rate in American history. It was plenty of turmoil, conflict, and so on. But nevertheless, there was a sense that the country's growing and developing, and you'll have a good young people, say, in college could say, okay, I'm going to have a decent future. That's pretty much gone. There's a sense of hopelessness, of decline, of we've reached our peak, the current generation is not going to live better than their parents. That kind of feeling is very widespread. And in that sense, and there's some reality to it, so the talk about Make America Great Again is not totally empty.
Thomas Frank, the writer, wrote What's the Matter with Kansas, in which he explained how working class people actually vote against their own economic interests, told me in a recent interview that he's concerned that the next time around that there's going to be a smooth-talking Trump, as he says, that will not piss people off, and he regards that as something very ominous.
We already have him. His name is Paul Ryan. I think he's more dangerous than Trump because he comes across as serious, thoughtful, spreadsheets, numbers. But you take a look at his programs, they're devastating. And yes, he may run. On the other hand, 4 years of Trump could very well carry us to a kind of tipping point on climate change, which are going to render other questions moot. Now, that sounds apocalyptic, but if you take a look at the actual developments today and the tendencies and Trump's policies, assuming he would implement them, it's a very dangerous mixture.
Well, Trump, in some ways, is a pretty easy target. I mean, the outrageous, contradictory statements that he makes and his breathtaking ignorance on certain issues. But doesn't that deflect from scrutiny on his opponent, Hillary Clinton? I'm looking at her comments that she made at the American Legion National Convention in Cincinnati in late August, in which it's just saturated with not just boilerplate rhetoric, which you might expect, but constant use of the words of values and exceptional and exceptionalism and American exceptionalism, and America is the indispensable nation. What about Hillary Clinton?
Who fails to use that terminology? That's absolutely standard in liberal democratic rhetoric. The indispensable nation is Madeleine Albright, Bill Clinton. These are the Democrats. There's simply virtually no deviation from it. Take a look at the what are considered the liberal intellectual journals, New York Review of Books, an article by Samantha Power, UN ambassador, starts by quoting Henry Kissinger with his usual rhetoric very favorably and says, well, he's not quite right because he doesn't recognize how important it is for us to enlist other countries in our marvelous and efforts to do good all over the world. Where don't you find this? Take the simple word aggression. Take a look at how it's used. Nobody has any hesitation in describing Putin's takeover of Crimea as aggression, his actions in eastern Ukraine as aggression. That's aggression, straight out, no qualification. Have you ever heard the term used for the U.S. invasion of Iraq? Ever? I mean, except, you know, in our discussions. Could any member of the articulate classes use that phrase in the mainstream? I mean, so virtually inconceivable. In fact, even take Crimea. Whatever you think about it, yeah, it was an illegal act. Does the United States have a better claim to Guantanamo Bay than Russia has to Crimea? Oh, have much less of a claim. Took it at gunpoint, has no historical connections, no justification, it's over a century, refused to give it back, even though as soon as the country got independence from the U.S., it immediately demanded it back, and holding it only in order to impede and undermine Cuba's development, its major port. It's the site of the worst human rights abuses in Cuba by far. In fact, the whole hemisphere, except maybe for Colombia. Is that aggression? Is it anything? I mean, is it even a question? The inability to face elementary facts is overwhelmingly true of the liberal, intellectual, articulate sectors of the population that are involved in commentary and discussion. And the rhetoric that you quote from Clinton comes straight out of that.
A constant theme that you've been writing and lecturing about, and we've been talking about over the years, is the enormous chasm between what people want and policy. For example, just a most recent example, the results of a Suffolk University USA Today poll indicates that 76% of respondents want Jill Stein of the Green Party and Gary Johnson of the Libertarian Party to participate in the presidential debates.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a rule, a 15% rule, polling rule, which could be changed. Frankly, I think they should participate, but I don't think it'll make any difference. I mean, I was glad that, say, Denis Kucinich could participate in the primary debates. Bernie Sanders' participation was very significant. This would be helpful, but those are not the crucial issues. I mean, much more significant is how much of the population would like to have a decent health care system, say. I mean, over the years, it's often been, depending how the question is asked, often large majorities in favor of some kind of national health care like other countries have. Just can't get it through. What percentage of the population is opposed to the U.S. law that bans the government from negotiating drug prices? There is such a legal provision, which means drug prices go to the skyrocket. Very few polls, but the few I've seen, it runs around 85%. Does anybody care? The disparity between people's attitudes and policy is overwhelming. And in fact, there's plenty of straight academic political science research which documents the gap between preferences and policies and the fact that for a large majority of the population, their own representatives simply pay no attention to their attitudes. They don't represent their constituents. They represent business interests and private wealth.
Sarah Jaffe's written a new book called Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt, in which she writes that democracy in this country is failing, or perhaps, as some are coming to believe, that it never really worked.
Well, you know, democracy is not a simple one-dimensional phenomenon. So if you go back to the founding of the country, the founders didn't want to have a democracy. The Constitution is basically an aristocratic document. The population, James Madison's main framer, his view was that government should protect the minority of the opulent from the majority, and democracy would be extremely dangerous, which is a common view. There was a popular reaction to that. There was a commitment to a kind of radical democracy of a complex kind, which did, to a substantial extent, democratize the country. But there's a battle all the way, right through to the present. So is democracy functioning? Partially, more so sometimes than others. Right now, we happen to be in a period of quasi-democratic plutocracy, which is reversible, but it's been going that way for the last generation. That's during the neoliberal period. So to say democracy is or is not functioning, I think, is a little misleading. It assumes it's a yes or no question, and it's not. It's a many-dimensional question. In many respects, the country is quite free. In other respects, the government is quite unresponsive to popular opinion.
You're listening to Noam Chomsky on elections and voting. This is Alternative Radio, celebrating 30 years of independent broadcasting. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. A recent Gallup poll demonstrates that 82% of Americans believe the country is what's called on the wrong track. Talk about that and also the extraordinarily high negativities that both Trump and Clinton have. They're deeply unpopular. They're regarded as untrustworthy and dishonest. Have you ever seen that before in a presidential campaign?
We've never seen quite this, but notice that it's an instance of something much broader. For several decades now, attitudes towards all institutions have become very negative. Support for Congress has sometimes been down to literally single digits. There have been polls where people said, look, let's throw them all out and start all over. Banks are hated. Corporations are hated. The Federal Reserve, which people don't know anything about, is hated. The government, of course, hated. About the only institution that gets consistently pretty high ratings is the military, okay, for other reasons, which, separate reasons. But the distaste for the candidates, I think, is just a reflection for the sense of malaise about everything. Everything's going wrong. And that's been increasing for quite a few years. There's polls going way back showing that Maybe 80% of the population will say that the government doesn't work for the people, it works for a big interest looking out for themselves. Now that goes back decades, up and back, depending on the poll. But so I think these are quite general phenomena. And it's that kind of feeling that Trump-style rhetoric about make America great again is attempting to appeal to. Everything's going wrong, the future looks bleak. Our children aren't going to live the way we did. There's major problems all over the place. Everyone in the world is pushing us around. Nobody's listening to us. Trump is now being denounced violently for saying that Putin is a stronger leader than Obama. I don't know exactly what he meant. Maybe he doesn't know what he meant, but the words literally mean, well, he gets what he wants and we don't. And that's a feeling that people quite definitely have. Like, why isn't everyone in the Middle East just doing what we want them to do? Why is China building small bases in the South China Sea when we don't want them to? It's supposed to be an American lake. Note, all of this assumes that the world is supposed to be ours. South China Sea is an American lake. The countries on the border of Russia are ours to control. There's no question about, say, Russian forces in Mexico or Chinese aircraft carriers off the coast of California. The world's supposed to be ours, and people aren't listening anymore. So what's happening? Let's make America great again. All of this falls together in a sense of what the poll says. We're going in the wrong direction. And it's pretty much highly personal. I mean, a family can see that their children do not have the kind of future that they themselves aspire to. And in fact, social mobility in the United States, contrary to the Horatio Alger myths, is quite low among developed societies. Now, the chance of getting ahead happens to be statistically low by comparative standards. And of course, there's tremendous poverty. And just travel around the city, it looks like the place is collapsing. I mean, I can remember the first time I went to Europe, was in the early 50s, not long after the war. Europe was still recovering from the war. When you came back to the United States, it was like coming back to some kind of paradise as compared with Europe. Now it's the other way around. You go to a poor country like, say, Portugal, and come back to the United States, it looks like you're turning to a place, to wreckage, you know. That's everywhere. And the infrastructure's collapsing. The roads don't work. The bridges are falling. We don't have a healthcare system. Schools are declining. There was a phrase that John Kenneth Galbraith used back in the 1950s about private affluence, public squalor. By now it's become pretty dramatic. Private affluence for very narrow sectors is going through the roof, and public squalor is all over the place. Almost everywhere you look, is one of the few countries where you can't take a high-speed train, for example, just about everywhere. And people can see that. They can see their children loaded down with debt for school, not having good opportunities. It's easy to blame foreigners, immigrants, people who are worse off than you are. That's Trump's line. I mean, that's standard. But the background phenomena are not unreal.
Student debt is at $1.3 trillion. Within the last week, I've talked to a couple of young people in Boulder. One is $100,000 in debt, and the other is $40,000 in debt.
And furthermore, it's designed so you can't get rid of it. You can't declare bankruptcy the way a business can, the way Trump has done over and over again, and start over. It's with you forever. Your Social Security can be garnished by the government. So yes, it's a permanent burden and a very strong disciplinary force. It means your options are limited. You go back to, say, the 1960s and think about the young students who became involved in student activism. There was a general feeling at that time, look, I can take off a couple of years and become an activist and so on. Then I'll go back and I'll pick up my life. Not anymore. Now you're stuck. You're trapped. You try to go back, you won't be able to. You've got to subordinate yourself to power. You don't have the choices. Now, it's not 100% by any means, but it's substantial.
Well, there's the Black Lives Matter movement. There's been more activism among Native peoples in the United States, as well as Canada, as well. There's an I Don't Know More movement there.
Yeah, there's plenty of activism. In fact, if you counted the number of people who were students, young people who were engaged in something or other, it's probably higher than the 60s. Actually, walk down the halls here or any college and just take a look at what's on the bulletin boards. It's much more than it would have been in the 60s. On the other hand, it's taking place in a general kind of intellectual atmosphere of concern and fear, which did not exist then. The idea that you could just become engaged and then go on with your life, you'll have a good career, everything's open to you, that's gone. So now you're taking chances. And notice the groups you're mentioning, they're oppressed groups. They are active. Others may be joining them.
I remember when Bernie Sanders visited Boulder, which is where the University of Colorado is located, and he talked about free tuition, tuition-free college and university education, a huge response from the massive crowd there of something like 10,000 people on a hot August afternoon. Certainly that's something that could be done, but again, there's that gap between what the public wants and policy.
Well, not only could be done, but it's very feasible. I mean, it's not like solving global warming. There are plenty of countries that have free higher education. Take Germany. It may be the most successful of all state capitalist countries. That's free education. Finland, which comes out at or near the top of most international studies, is free education. Take our neighbor, Mexico. It's a poor country. It has a pretty good higher education system. The quality is very high, even though they don't have resources, so no faculty salaries and so on. But it's free. In fact, take the United States. Public education, higher education was virtually free here in the not long ago, 1950s, 1940s. The GI Bill gave free education and subsidies to large parts of the population, people who would never have gone to college. I went to an Ivy League school in 1945, Penn, University of Pennsylvania, and the tuition was $100, and you could easily get a scholarship. And it was a much poorer country then, remember. We were a far richer country than we were in the 1950s. It's hard to imagine any economic reason, if you look at comparatively and historically, why higher education can't be accessible to people just as, at least in principle, secondary education is. Those are social and political decisions, not economic necessities. And it's certainly not pie in the sky to say, let's do what other countries done and what we've done in the past. Incidentally, public education at the lower level is also under attack. The charter school efforts are fundamentally, I mean, you can see why they appeal to poor people who have a rotten school nearby. But the fact is that overall, they're essentially an attack on the public education system.
What do you make of Bernie Sanders' Our Revolution organization that he's formed now in the wake of his defeat?
Well, personally, I would prefer that, and I've always preferred, that he would have dropped the word revolution, because these are mildly reformist efforts, initiatives, which are quite good. We could use mildly reformist initiatives, but not give people the illusion that there's some dramatic change taking place. So, for example, his proposals right throughout the campaign, which I support, I favor, I think they're very good, but it's basically New Deal liberalism. His proposals, for example, wouldn't have surprised somebody like Dwight Eisenhower. Eisenhower famously said that anyone who doesn't accept the New Deal doesn't belong in American politics. Well, that's a long time ago. But Sanders is calling for a revival of essentially New Deal-style welfare state policies, which don't challenge or question the fundamental system of capitalist authoritarianism. That's not even discussed. So that's fine. It's good, a basis for doing better, but it's not a revolution. As for the new organization, I just don't know what it is. I mean, there have been some talk, but I don't know exactly what it's supposed to be. On the other hand, there are a number of popular movements developing out of the Sanders campaign. I don't know exactly how they're supposed to be related to his new revolution, but they seem to be doing some interesting things, like the Brand New Congress group, which looks pretty sensible. Well, reformist, of course, but there's nothing wrong with that.
Talk about what's called lesser evil voting and or strategic voting, and also respond to people who are going to say, I want to vote my conscience, or conversely, bring it on. I'm going to vote for Trump. Let's accelerate. Let's get to the revolution.
Well, lesser evil voting has a should be simply called elementary rationality and elementary morality. Let's take the concept of voting your conscience. Now, suppose you happen to be, say, in Ohio. Let's say it'll probably be a swing state. Let's assume it is. You have several choices. One choice is to vote for Trump because you think he's better. Fine, no question of lesser evil voting. You're voting for the lesser evil. Okay. Another possibility is to vote for Clinton because you think Trump is extremely dangerous. A third choice is to either abstain or vote for, say, maybe Jill Stein. Then there's something called arithmetic, which we can't question, you know. Arithmetic tells you if you're choosing to vote for Jill Stein instead of Clinton, you're voting for Trump. That's arithmetic. Okay, so that we don't have to argue about. So if you think you're voting your conscience when you vote for Jill Stein, what you're saying is my conscience is I prefer Trump. That's what your conscience is. And it's the same with lesser evil voting altogether. The business of voting your conscience is, do you really care just about how you feel, or do you care about what happens to the world? If you care about what you feel, you don't have any conscience. You're not a moral agent at all. So stop talking about conscience. You don't have any. If you care about the effect on others, then you'll ask, well, what are the consequences of voting for Trump, which is what you're doing if you refuse to vote for the alternative in a swing state? Again, arithmetic. So all of this is kind of basically elementary rationality. And frankly, I think this entire discussion should take maybe 5 minutes of our time, period. You think it through, fact's pretty obvious, then you go on with the things that matter. Constant activism, organizing these popular movements we were talking about, that's what people should be engaged in. Maybe electoral work at lower levels, school boards, state legislatures, building organizations, activism on the environment, and so on. That's what should be taking our time. The fact that there's even discussion about this is an indication of how the left is trapped by the propaganda system. We have an enormous propaganda system which tries to focus people's attention and energy on the quadrennial extravaganza, and you shouldn't fall for that. It's not of no significance. It is of significance, but it's not the main story.
You call it a Hobson's choice.
Well, you pay it, it's real. Like if there's a hurricane, you can't say, I don't like it. It's there, so you do something. Maybe you go inside, but you don't become obsessed with it. There are other things. The quadrennial extravaganza, which is the right term for it, should occupy a few minutes of our time. Then you go back to what's important. In that few minutes, you should think through what is simply elementary morality and elementary rationality, and decide, am I going to vote for the worst person or the best person? And how, if your conscience is allows you to pay attention to the consequences for others, not just your own feelings, if you're at least a moral agent, you're not going to try to get the worst person in. As to the idea, bring it on, yeah, then it'll be great. Well, we've lived through that. German Communist Party in 1932 was one example.
And they voted for Hitler.
They said, well, there's no difference between the Social Democrats and the Nazis, so let's just bring the Nazis on, then we'll have a revolution. Yeah, we had a revolution, but not the one they were talking about.
Well, couldn't one argue that this lesser evil voting approach has given us, arguably, Hillary, one of the most right-wing Democratic nominees in memory, Hillary Clinton?
We could say that would be totally irrational. Lesser evil voting didn't bring Clinton. What brought Clinton is 30 years of neoliberalism, nothing to do with lesser evil voting. You wouldn't have a better candidate if you'd voted for worse people. You'd have worse candidates, okay? So that's just, again, totally irrational. Lesser evil voting, again, is just elementary morality and rationality, willingness to agree that arithmetic exists and that you should care about other people. If you think arithmetic exists and I should care about other people, then you carry out strategic voting, period. It should take 5 minutes. And that has nothing to do with bringing about Hillary Clinton, who is straight in the history of Democratic Party politics since the shift to the right in the last 30 or 40 years. In fact, her positions, if you look at them closely, are domestically at least more progressive than Obama's, certainly more than Bill Clinton's.
It seems that sectors of the ruling class, large sectors and important ones, have turned on Trump. Why is that?
It's frightening. If they're worried about him, it's in part in the kind of national security apparatus. It's not just neocons. People who are pretty, people like, say, Bruce Blair or others, very sensible strategic analysts, are just concerned. What happens when you get an ignorant, thin-skinned megalomaniac in a position where he could blow up the world? They don't like that. In the corporate sector, they're concerned that he may, although if you take a look at his actual proposals, they're basically the ultra-reactionary Paul Ryan-style proposals. But there is a concern that a guy who's totally unpredictable, says whatever comes to his mind, might do whatever comes to his mind, might blow up the system that they own. I mean, they own the country. They don't want to see it disappear.
So they're looking for a good manager.
They're looking for a sensible, reasonable manager, not a guy who might destroy everything they have. They can even look at his business career. Bankruptcy after bankruptcy, total corruption, probably his debts may very well outweigh his assets, a blowhard, has no business experience except building big hotels. That's not the kind of guy they want to run their enterprises.
Yeah, but given all that, isn't that giving Hillary a free pass?
That's a very funny argument. It's not a free pass. It's like saying if there's a hurricane coming and I pay attention to it, I'm giving it a free pass. It's there. We happen to live in a social and political system in which there are two political organizations, one of them essentially moderate Republican, Clinton, another off the spectrum, and we can say I don't like it, but we can't say it's not there. There's no free pass. It's there, period, like it or not. We can try to do something about it, but to do something about it begins by accepting its reality and trying to change it. And you don't change it by voting for the worst person. You change it by spending 5 minutes realizing that we got to keep the worst person out, and then go back to the serious activity of organizing and activism.
Well, let's assume Hillary Rodham Clinton will be our first woman president. Are there any policy areas where there will be a departure from Obama that you think will be significant? I know this is a speculative question.
Well, that depends on how the population reacts, including the left. First of all, I don't think it's an open and shut business. The polls are pretty ambiguous, and there's a lot that can happen. But if she's elected, what the activists should be doing is holding her feet to the fire. If you take a look at the programs, some of them on paper are pretty reasonable. Make her do them. So, for example, she's calling for a public option in the healthcare system. If there's a public option, it means we might develop the kind of healthcare system that the public has wanted for a long time, that other countries have, and that would overcome the incredible scandal of the U.S. healthcare system. Okay, let's push it. Don't just drop it. Organize, actively lobby, demonstrate, town meetings, whatever you can do to compel that policy to be implemented. Same on other issues. So one of her policies is to shift all households to solar energy in 4 years. Okay? Make her do it. Do things like what made Roosevelt implement reformist actions. He wouldn't have done them if it hadn't been for CIO organizing militancy on the shop floor, public activism and so on. So instead of standing in the corner and carping and saying, look, she's terrible, make her do the things that she's claims to be in favor of and push her on to better things. Same on international affairs. Get her to withdraw the buildup of NATO forces from the Russian border. Fine, let's get her to do that. End the rapid increase in the modernization of the nuclear weapon system. It doesn't have to be done. There are policies that can be that an organized activist public, which the left, if it's serious, should have a central role in, can shift the balance on what policies will be implemented. And that's what you should be doing. In fact, not after the election, but right now. That's why I say the whole election issue should take us 5 minutes. We should stop talking about it. All this discussion about lesser evil voting is a total waste of time. It's an obvious conclusion. Then you go back to your serious activities all the time. And there are, including elements of her actual program, which can be pressed, and of course they're not the limits. You can go well beyond that.
I'm interested that, you keep using the term the left as if it were a coherent force in the country.
Yeah, it certainly isn't. Yeah. It's kind of a mood. There's a broad mood of kind of leftish-oriented concerns and activism. It showed up in the Sanders campaign, and it takes many different forms. There are elements of it which I think are pretty destructive. There are other elements which are quite positive. And
what are the destructive elements?
You mentioned them. Mm-hmm. Bring on the worst and we'll have a revolution. We've heard that for 60, 70 years and always comes out the same way. If you want to change the world for the better, you have to face the fact of what the world is. The United States is not in a revolutionary situation by any means. And if you want it to get there, you're going to have to build the popular base for it. Those who take the word revolution seriously, who are saying, look, we got to get rid of the capitalist system, if they're serious, what you try to do is press the options within the system as far as you can. And if the public agrees, we want to go farther, and the resistance of the system is too strong, then you have a revolution, not before. Not when you have a small sect saying, okay, let's break the windows in the banks and have a revolution.
What do you have coming up?
More of the same.
A trip to Italy?
Yeah, and then plenty of others.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, bye.
That was Noam Chomsky on elections and voting. I talked with him at his office at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Noam Chomsky, the internationally renowned MIT professor, has been a leading voice for peace and social justice for many decades. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado, celebrating 30 years of independent broadcasting. We offer our weekly program free of charge to all public and community radio stations in the United States, Canada, Australia, and beyond. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the corporate-controlled media, such as Ralph Nader, Thomas Frank, Naomi Klein, Vandana Shiva, Chris Hedges, and Bill McKibben. Since its inception, AR has recorded and archived hundreds of Noam Chomsky programs. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, or written transcript of today's program, Noam Chomsky on Elections and Voting, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.